Good afternoon, everyone. It's about 2:04 and 50 seconds, almost 2:05 on your clock dial. You're listening to Movement Museum on CKUT, which is 90.3 on your radio dial, and or 91.7 if you're listening to us through cable, and so on and so forth. We're here talking about Dance Over the Airwaves. We have a sort of yet another memorial broadcast. Last Sunday, Merce Cunningham died. And for those of you who don't know who Merce Cunningham is, then you should probably turn off your radio and go switch to a different station. Merce Cunningham was 90 years old. He was probably one of the most, I would think, probably the most influential choreographer who was living up until last Sunday, to make a little bit of gallows humor. And probably one of the top three influential choreographers for modern dance just about ever, although I could be wrong. And as a consequence, we got I'm going to be talking to Jose Navas of Company Flack, Louis Robitaille of BJM Dance. We got a couple of obituaries, and then on top of that, yes, we are going to, because now I think this is the third death in dance which has happened, so we can sort of then slowly ease our way into nicer things and so on and so forth. And at which point there is now part two of the interview I did with Robin Henderson of Dance Animal. And now that the Zoo Fest and the Fringe Fest are over, we can play all we want about her and sort of get into her head about how and what she did. There's, as usual, the awesome calendar, awesome Montreal dance calendar. There's the audition list and a whole whack of other stuff that's going to be happening. So, if you guys give me a second, I'm going to crank up the Dawn Upshaw doing Lonely Town, which is the sort of thing where this is the sort of stuff that Merce Cunningham and John Cage would have been listening to back at the time when they were starting out and everything. But by listening to Dawn Upshaw sing Lonely Town, it will enable me to push the buttons and knobs and dials so as to get Louis Robitaille up on the phone. So give me one second, please, because I only have 10 fingers.
Told me, Chip, my boy, there'll come a time when you leave home. If you should ever hit New York, be sure to see the Hippodrome.
The Hippodrome.
The Hippodrome.
Did I hear right? Did you say the Hippodrome?
And yes, that is the Hippodrome. But right now, we have Louis Robitaille, le directeur artistique du BGM Danse sur la téléphone. Est-ce que vous êtes là?
suis là. Est-ce que vous m'entendez bien?
Oui, oui, très bien. Merci. Et vous?
Oui, je vous entends bien. Oui. Je vous parle d'un portable. Alors, parfois, c'est un peu hasardeux.
Pour cet instant, ça marche.
Ah, très bien.
Oui, mon première question, c'est oui, où est-ce que vous étiez quand vous avez entendu que M. Cunningham a meurt?
Vous allez trouver ça un peu étrange, probablement, mais probablement pas. J'étais ici en studio de danse.
OK.
Alors, avant hier, lundi, de retour au travail, j'ai appris donc le décès de M. Cunningham.
Oui, c'est une chose qui n'était pas prévue, mais une chose qui n'était pas une surprise.
Mais prévisible. Non, on est tous de passage sur cette terre, après tout, non?
Oui, et oui, alors que, parce que moi, je suis pas une amateur à danse, mais nouveau dans la scène danse montréalaise. Et moi, je connais Merce Cunningham comme un nom et je pense probablement que j'ai vu des choses de lui quelque part. Mais alors que votre vie est la danse, comment vous pouvez expliquer qu'est-ce que Merce Cunningham a été à vous? Ou en anglais, parce que mon français n'est pas tellement terriblement bon. What did Merce Cunningham mean to you?
Oh, vous savez, est-ce que je peux vous parler en français?
Oui, oui, bien sûr.
Oui, oui. Vous savez, moi, je c'est pas peut-être très bien à dire, mais je ne suis pas vraiment un amateur de Merce Cunningham. Par contre,
ça c'est pas le cas.
Mais ça c'est un goût personnel. Je ne suis pas vraiment amateur de toute cette période de la danse américaine, donc le mouvement moderne. Avec Cunningham, Martha Graham, Rosalie Mann, et donc voilà. Donc ça c'est un goût personnel, mais ce que je respecte énormément de Merce Cunningham, c'est l'innovation qu'il a amené à la danse. Il a laissé tomber toutes les conventions pour se lancer dans une démarche qui est beaucoup plus abstraite, et il a poussé ça à l'extrême. Donc, la représentation en elle-même n'est plus basée sur des arguments, sur des histoires. Il a tout simplifié et ramené à la pureté, disons. On a laissé tomber les chichis des costumes, des histoires souvent tirées de la mythologie grecque, des accessoires... Et même d'une forme d'interprétation qui était de mise à l'époque. Donc lui, il a laissé tout tomber ça. Il a pas laissé tout tomber, il a tout aboli. Donc pour cette raison, je pense que c'est un innovateur. Et dans ce sens, je pense que de là son importance.
Oui, ça c'est une chose que pour moi, je sais que alors que le danse a passé beaucoup plus loin de où il était quand il a débuté.
Ah oui, absolument.
C'est un jour, mais sans lui, c'était impossible à arriver où nous sommes maintenant.
Non, vous savez, ce sont toujours des gens qui poussent les limites, qui vont un peu à l'extrême. On utilise souvent le mot avant-gardiste pour pousser justement le domaine ou les limites d'un art, les pousser... pour que, justement, cet art puisse évoluer. On a besoin des gens comme ça. Aujourd'hui, on ne parlerait sûrement pas de langage ballet contemporain, langage plus d'improvisation, même d'une démarche qui vient de l'improvisation, s'il n'y avait pas eu des individus comme Merce Cunningham.
Exactement. Et oui, mais une dernière question. Est-ce que tu penses qu'il y a des gens maintenant qui dansent, qui peuvent atteindre les niveaux que Merce Cunningham a atteint lui-même? Qui est-ce qu'ils sont?
Ah, vous savez, des gens qui sont influents dans le monde de la danse?
Oui, exactement.
Oh, il y en a plusieurs, vous savez. Il y a, je crois que chaque pays a son monstre sacré. Vous savez, il y a eu aussi la période américaine avec Georges Balanchine. Chaque époque aussi, ces chorégraphes ici à Montréal, on pourrait en nommer plusieurs à l'international, mais Montréal est quand même une plaque internationale de la danse à travers le monde. Et on n'a qu'à prendre des gens qui ont influencé énormément le paysage de cet art ici à Montréal, comme Édouard Locke, Marie Chouinard, Jean-Pierre Perrault. Maintenant, on parle de José Navas au Canada.
Je vais lui parler un peu plus tard dans l'émission.
Et au Canada, il y a un mouvement féminin très, très fort en ce moment également au Canada. Crystal Pite, Aja Barton, Émilie Molnar, des personnes de l'ouest du Canada. Donc, écoutez... Il y en a des dizaines, c'est bien entendu, mais ce qu'il y avait de particulier à l'époque, c'est qu'il y avait une poignée de chorégraphes et justement de s'être séparés, de s'être mis à l'écart de tout ce qui existait, fait de lui une personne exceptionnelle.
Cool. Alors, merci beaucoup. J'espère que la prochaine fois quand on va se parler, c'est une chose qui est un peu plus heureuse qu'une chose assez dommage ou assez sérieuse que ça.
C'est dommage, mais en même temps, il ne faut pas être tragique. Vous savez, comme je vous disais, on est tous de passage sur cette terre et je pense qu'on doit célébrer les traces que cet homme aura laissées.
Voilà. Oui, exactement.
Ouais, exactement. Je vous souhaite une bonne journée.
OK, merci.
Merci.
Bye-bye.
Au revoir.
And yes, that was just Louis Robitaille, who was the artistic director of BGM Danse. As I had mentioned briefly in there, later we will be talking to José Navas, who runs Compagnie Flac. And there, the thing that I found interesting about José Navas in his company Flac is in his bio, it says he began his dance training in Caracas and continued it in New York at the Merce Cunningham Studio. So I think we will be able to get a different sort of perspective. But there, to me, it is the sort of thing that, yeah, just the idea that he was dancing until he was like 70 and that he was still working on stage and choreographing things and so on and so forth. But yes, deep breath now. I hear as part of the sort of memorial to Merce Cunningham, his longtime sweetie, because I really can't stand that term, life partner, that is imposed upon everybody who doesn't have your standard issue sexuality. But his longtime sweetie, John Cage, actually composed a piece of music. He composed lots and lots of music for Merce Cunningham. I was able to get my hands on one of them, which is this suite for toy piano, which was made for a dance here in 1948. It got premiered someplace in, I think, North Carolina originally, which was at the time a hotbed of all sorts of avant-garde stuff. And just so that you guys don't get bored of hearing my voice, we're going to play it for you now.
Thank you. Charlotte Higgins of The Guardian wrote about the day she met Merce Cunningham. 3 years ago, I had the great good fortune to meet Merce Cunningham, who died aged 90 at the weekend. I had been commissioned by The Guardian Review to write a profile of him. I thus had the privilege of meeting him at his studio at 55 Bethune Street, New York, and watched his dancers rehearse Ocean, which they would bring later that year to the Roundhouse in London. Watching the dancers go through the piece was completely mesmerizing. In fact, I always find dancers rehearsing completely mesmerizing. What got me was the way these ordinary, gossipy young people who occasionally had to be asked to shut up as they gathered at the side of the studio turned into uncanny creatures with quite inhuman grace and strength as soon as they ran into the circular area that represented the space in which Ocean would be performed. Even then, of course, Cunningham was frail. A tiny creature curled up in a wheelchair, but still with that sense of erectness and poise that makes dancers unmistakable. You could still discern the lighter-than-air, puckishly agile figure of the 1940s and 50s. At the top of my transcript, which I looked up this morning, I wrote, "The long, erect neck has folded in on itself a little. Eloquent hands a little claw-like, purple age spots, bright eyes over big, cushiony, semicircular pouches. One drop of moisture edges down over course of interview. At one point in the interview, I asked how he felt about not being able to use his body fully. 'Oh, it's terrible,' he said, and laughed, because I would like to dance." He was a wonderful interview subject. For a start, there was his great age. He had danced with Martha Graham and was a living link to the birth of modernism. But he was incredibly thoughtful, kind, intelligent, and precise, and had a wonderfully attentive, it seemed to me, grasp on life. I loved what he said about New York as a pervasive inspiration and influence. One thing that always fascinated me, even as a child, was just watching people in the street, particularly in New York. I saw somebody once at a street corner and he kept shuffling his feet to decide which foot he was going to step out on. He finally stepped out on his right foot. I began to watch people. 95% of people always stepped off on their right foot. They'd shift their balance. I practiced, and when I went out walking, using my left, just to give myself that experience. I think that in New York somehow the sense of art in the city is so much bigger, and so is the pressure. One could have worked in San Francisco, as a number of dancers did, and the live thing is a little easier. But here in New York, you could turn a corner and see something you hadn't realized or thought about. That fascinated me. That no matter how much I had gone a certain way, if I just took another route, I could see or experience something new. Of course, that was a reflection of both Cunningham and John Cage's interest in the effect of chance. I enjoyed the idea of life on the street of New York being like a giant chance procedure. One of the most important aspects of Cunningham's art, of course, was the revolutionary abandonment of a planned direct relationship between dance steps and the accompanying score. Except for a broadly temporal one, i.e. music and dance stop and start at the same time. He told me about the genesis of this approach. I met Cage and he suggested that we do a program together back in the 1940s. I had made solos previous to that, but not to any great extent, and I was still with the Graham Company. But Cage and I made this program. I did 6 solos and he did some music. He composed the music for the dances and some more of his own. We evolved this system of working, which was called, for lack of a better phrase, a rhythmic structure. Say, for example, we decided that this dance was going to be 3 minutes long, we divided it into 10 parts. Then the actual composition we did separately. He had the structure and I had it, but I made the dance not to what he was going to do, but to the structure. And those pieces were for prepared piano, almost all of them. I hadn't worked this way before. Of course, I'd done very little work at all. But I found it so difficult because I had to depend upon myself, first of all. But I thought, okay, if that's what it is, do it. And I remember at one point in one of the solos when we got together, I did something which I thought was a very strong movement. And there was no sound at all. But right after it came a sound. And that was a small revelation. I remember it very clearly. The idea that the sound and the music didn't have to go together. And that was one of the starts. Lucky me to have met Merce Cunningham. The dance world has lost one of its greatest pioneers. He will be much mourned.
Thank you very much, Rachel. That was from The Guardian, I think it was Monday or Tuesday?
Yeah, Monday, I think, from Charlotte Higgins.
Yes, thank you. And now we have Jose Navas on the line. Can you hear us, Mr. Navas?
Yes, I can hear you. Hello.
Cool. And yes, thank you very, very much for agreeing to talk at this time.
No.
Yeah, first question I've been asking sort of everybody is, where were you when you heard that Merce Cunningham had died?
Well, I was rehearsing that day, Monday. And then I just went to the metro close to my studio to buy lunch. And I saw in the metro station, they had those new flashes, you know, all the time going. And I just saw that it said Merce Cunningham died at 90 years old. And at the same time, my cell phone was ringing, and it was a friend of mine just calling me to tell me the same thing. So that was strange. I had to cancel the rest of my rehearsal because it was a little bit surprising. I knew, obviously, that he was very old, and I knew it was going to happen soon. But it was a surprise, especially because it was Sunday night that he died, and I didn't hear anything Monday morning. Going to the studio, yeah,
and there it's in Richmond, because I'm just sort of in what would be called a newbie to this whole dance scene. I'm aware of Merce Cunningham. I have a feeling at some point I've seen documentaries about him and so on and how influential he is, but yeah, to get to the crux of the matter, what did he sort of mean to you, and how influential or uninfluential was he to you?
Well, Merce was very very influential because for a lot of people, even for those who haven't seen his work, Merce actually sort of gave a twist to modern dance. He served, if you will, as the link between the sort of mid-century choreographers as Martha Graham and Jose Limon, who were American choreographers that utilized sort of the American history, and they were very much about dance with meaning and emotion. And Merce, in the 60s, sort of comes out of that sort of dance world and comes out with a dance that is about movement and is not about meaning. He comes out with choreography that is not a choreography that's going to tell you a story, but it's a choreography that is going to show you what the human body can do in the space. So between the mid-century choreographers and the postmoderns in the 70s, like Trisha Brown and Twyla Tharp, there is Merce Cunningham. And that link that Merce became, it really sort of changed the way we saw dance. It was the first time we were able to see a technique that was, it was very, very formal and classic as classical ballet, but it was actually just working more as a visual artist would work with an instrument. And for me, it was a huge influence because I started studying dance with the Cunningham technique back in Venezuela. So in Venezuela, the most formal technique we had in Caracas was a little school that gave Cunningham technique. And then later on, I went to New York to study with Merce, and I studied in his school for 4 years. And as changed my way of dancing and seeing dance, thousands and thousands of people went through that school from all over the world. So again, possibly for those who haven't seen the work of Merce, possibly you have seen it through the work of others, because he was one presence in the dance community that did amazing work, but it also formed a lot of people, a lot of choreographers and dancers.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm slowly learning, unfortunately, after the fact, and sort of realizing just how far and wide his sort of influence had spread. Yeah, and then if I can ask a really stupid question, is did his company, or when was the last, I would imagine his company had come up here to perform, but do you happen to know when the last time they performed here?
I think it was in 2005. That they came here to Montreal. Back then, we had a festival called Find.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in, I believe, it's 2005, to Place des Arts.
Then there's half a chance. No, I would assume that if I had seen him, I would remember. So then that.
Yes, no, absolutely. Like it will be something you would remember because it's a very strange sort of type of work. It's a very, very strange. Either people like it and love it, or people just leave the theater, you mm-hmm. know, in the middle of a piece. And that was Merce, that once you see it, you will always remember. It's a little bit, in pop music, we have York,
that it can be extremely wonderful or it can be extremely strange. Mm-hmm. And Merce Cunningham was a little bit like that in dance throughout all his career. Even at 90 years old, he was still producing pieces that, you know, you were in a theater and you were seeing people leaving the theater feeling, I don't know what this is about. And you have the other half of the theater in awe because it's quite beautiful if you're patient and if you give it a time, you know.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, was there, I assume you are a fan of his, given that you have gone through the training and everything like that?
Yeah.
Is there a specific piece of yours that is favorite, more meaningful to you, or more significant?
Well, there is the Rainforest that I saw in New York. It's a piece of Merce where he is the piece that he collaborated with Andy Warhol. And it's this beautiful combination of the choreography of Merce Cunningham. The set on a stage is Andy Warhol's sort of floating silver pillows. And the costume is by Robert Rauschenberg, the visual artist. And that piece, it was the first piece of Merce that I saw in New York live. And it always stayed with me. And there is also Summer Space that we saw here in Montreal. And that is a piece in collaboration with Robert Rauschenberg. And it's a beautiful, beautiful painting that is the backdrop by Rauschenberg, and the costumes are made by Rauschenberg as well. And it's just like looking at a gorgeous painting that suddenly comes alive and starts to move.
Well, at which point, thank you very, very much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you very much.
I hope that the next time that we talk, that we have another opportunity to talk, and that the next time it is for something that is not, it's not death related.
I hope so too.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And yes, that was just Jose Navas of Company Flack. And yeah, I'm sorry, Rachel. Did you have questions? Should I call him back and not?
No, that's fine.
And yeah, now I need to push some buttons and look cross-eyed and try and figure out what's happening here. I think the one that, you're the foreigner here, which is why I always end up giving you the Guardian and the Independent and all those well-written obituaries. It's there. I've, the one in the New York Times, because I have a feeling they sort of had an idea that his time was not long for this world. Although it's also, they do have probably a whack of obituaries for everybody who's famous from the age of 35 on up. But yeah, I want to give you a couple of, a little bit of it in an abridged version. And this was written by Alastair McCauley, who is the dance critic for the New York Times, and in my estimation, one of the better dance reviewers, dance critics out there. And Merce Cunningham, the revolutionary American choreographer, died Sunday night in his home in Manhattan. He was 90. His death was announced by the Cunningham Dance Foundation. Over the career of nearly seven decades, Mr. Cunningham went on posing but and what if questions, making people rethink the essence of dance and choreography. He went on doing so almost to the last. Until 1989, when he reached 70, he appeared in every single performance given by the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. In 1999, at 80, though frail and holding onto a bar, he danced a duet with Mikhail Baryshnikov at the New York State Theater in Lincoln Center. In April, he observed his 90th birthday with a 90-minute, nearly 90, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Even when it became known that he was fading, and friends began coming to bid farewell to him in recent days, he told one colleague that he was still creating dances in his head. Mr. Cunningham ranks among the foremost figures of artistic modernism and among the few who have transformed the nature and status of dance theater. Visionaries like Isadora Duncan, Sergei Diaghilev, I'm never going to be able to pronounce that name, and Martha Graham and George Balanchine. In his works, independence was central. Dancers were often alone, even in duets or ensembles, and music and design would act as environments, sometimes hostile ones. His movement, starting in its mixture of staccato and legato elements and unusually intense in its use of torso, legs, and feet, abounded in non-sequiturs. In his final years, while still known as avant-garde, he was almost routinely hailed as the world's greatest living choreographer. Mr. Cunningham had also been a non-para, Pareil Dancer. It's way easier to read than it is to recite. The British ballet teacher Richard Glassstone maintains that the three greatest dancers he ever saw were Fred Astaire, Margot Fonteyn, and Mr. Cunningham. He was American modern dance's equivalent of Nijinsky. The long neck, the animal intensity, the amazing leap. In old age, when he could no longer jump and when his feet were gnarled with arthritis, he remained a rivetingly dramatic performer capable of many moods. Yet he was always a creature of New York. Close to the founding members of the New York Schools of Music, Painting, and Poetry, Mr. Cunningham himself, along with Jerome Robbins and the younger Paul Taylor, led the way to founding what can retrospectively be called the New York School of Dance. These choreographers both combined and rejected the rival influences of modern dance and ballet, notably the senior choreographers Graham and Balanchine. They absorbed aspects of ordinary pedestrian movement, the natural world, and city life. They tested connections between private subject matter and theatrical expression, and they re-examined the relationship between dance and its sound accompaniment. With Graham and Balanchine, they made New York the world capital of choreography, and the New York School influenced the world in showing how pure dance could be major theater. Mr. Cunningham's most celebrated and revolutionary achievement, shared with the composer John Cage, his collaborator and companion, was to have dance and music created independently of each other. His choreography showed that dance was principally about itself, not music, while often suggesting that it could also be about many other things. Ambiguity and poetry were among Mr. Cunningham's favorite words when talking about choreography. So was theater. Wit and humor abounded in his works. His conversation was full of laughter and wry anecdotes, partly because dance was the main subject of his choreography, and partly because he often created dances requiring virtuoso skill. He did far more than any other choreographer to demonstrate that dance can be classical while being in most ways far from ballet. Mercier Philip Cunningham was born on April 16, 1919 in Centralia, Washington, the third of fourth children of Clifford Cunningham, a lawyer, and the former Mame Joach. One brother died before Mercier's birth. His two other brothers, Dorwin and Jack, followed their father into the legal profession. And then, yes, there are about another three pages that go on and on and on. I sort of am of the mind that we have now had three dancers who have died in sort of quick succession. So my mom, while she is of a scientific leaning, does every now and again subscribe to the superstition that things come in threes. And so, yeah, as Louis Robitaille, maybe we can go on celebrating, or we should celebrate, or but hopefully there will be no more deaths in the dance world for a while.
Yeah, I hope so too, but I'm also aware that choreographers who are in their late 90s are probably maybe thinking now is the time. There's something in the air.
What? How many choreographers in their late 90s can you name?
Oh, I can't name very many, but I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah, it is one of the things I was thinking about, because as you know, Len Dobbin died here. Not died here. He died recently, and he was a programmer, DJ, and influential member of the Montreal jazz community. And in going back over a lot of his old shows for the memorial broadcast that we did, I was struck by how many memorials he did. It was like almost every week. It was like this person died, that person died, that person died. And so he'd be playing their music and stuff like that, and you sort of got the feeling, wow, this is like, it could be taken as a sad show. And then I realized, wow, we've been doing this a little bit as well. But then I realized, for the most part, dance is a young person's game.
Mostly.
And so, for the most part, I think if we get through without doing stuff like this all that often, I'd be much happier. I'd much prefer to celebrate stuff while people are living this, as opposed to when they're dead.
Yes.
Okay.
The movement museum, yes, rather than the unmovement museum.
Okay. And so now, so as to get off this sort of, I don't know, gallows humor sort of stuff and trying to make light of a serious situation or smile while everything else is crawling down around you, I got an interview here with Robert Henderson, who is the choreographer, still living, the dancer, still living as well, of Dance Animal, which recently played at both the Fringe Festival and Zoo Fest. And I think we're going to now play part two. So give a listen in. Yeah.
Then I moved to Montreal and got my first gig at the Fringe Fest, and where I was running the box office. And again, really learning how a Fringe Festival works and what's the in and out and what shows sell and what do audiences want to see at a Fringe. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of Fringe artists make. They put on the show that they want to put on, which is a good start, but when you're competing against 100 other shows, it's smart business to go in with a show that people want to see. And with Dance Animal, you can't really go wrong with 10 energetic, attractive, funny people on stage that are charming and very watchable. So that's where that came from. So then in Montreal, I started working at the Fringe, but I simultaneously started working as a chef in restaurants. I worked at Robin des Bois. I cooked at Centre Paul Roulant. I work at the CPE's. I've worked at other restaurants. And then finally I decided I wanted to focus on directing, which is when I started working with Sidemark and Emma Tibaldo, Micheline Chevrier at the Centaur. And then also continuing with my dance choreography projects through Mainline. I choreographed Altar Boys last year, which was the Canadian premiere, which was really exciting. And all of those cumulative experiences, all the people I've met, everything I learned, I've applied it into Dance Animal. And because this was my very... Well, I've spent the last few years working on other people's projects and making their visions realize. I knew how I wanted to come at this. I knew I wanted to take it seriously. I only wanted to bring on people who were motivated and excited by this project and who were willing to work as hard as I was. And I got really lucky. I attracted all the right people, and the results, the fruits are showing at the Fringe Festival. And I, again, am beyond excited about the response and so thankful. It's really exciting and, quite frankly, overwhelming. The animal characters just was inspired only after we came up with the name for the group. Dan and I had a meeting. We were tossing around ideas for the name. And again, because people don't know what a comedy dance troupe is, so I really wanted to have the word dance or something that suggested dance, something that suggested movement and energy and was sexy. Because I definitely bring the sexy into Dance Animal. That was, again, very conscious choice. I wanted to not shy away from that just because we were comedic. In fact, I wanted to use it in a comedic way. So I just booked a trip to Africa, and animals were on my mind, and that classic theater question, what's your animal? And while we were having this, what are we going to name the group conversation, somehow we got sidetracked, as easily happens. And then I asked Dan what his animal was. And then all of a sudden, it was this moment of connect where he said Dance Animal. And we were both like, yes. And we had a lot of people discourage us from that name. Lots and lots and lots of people. They're like, it's not funny, it doesn't tell me who you are. And of course, I got insecure about that. And Dan was great. He's like, don't listen to the haters. He's like, we like the name, our dancers like the name, that's all that's important. And he was absolutely right. So we went with the name Dance Animal. And what I came into the first rehearsal with for the dancers is I was like, I'd like everybody to think of what their animal, they would like their animal to be. And the only rules were that, because there's such a huge animal kingdom, and I knew that everybody would gravitate to the same animals. So the rule was is that if there was a cat, I'm Dance Tiger, there couldn't be any other cats. If there's a bear, there's only one bear. If there's a fish, there's only one fish, et cetera, et cetera. And so the dancers went away and they really tried to think about which animal they felt they were connected to, or even just what animal they liked, or what animal name they thought was funny. It didn't have to be very, like, some of them went away and really, really thought about it deeply, and others were just like, I think the name Dance Pony sounds cute. and so they went with that. They came up with some great names. We have Dance Fox, Dance Hawk, Dance Hippo, Dance Gecko, Dance Squirrel, Dance Pony, Dance Salmon, Dance Wolf, Dance Banana. What happened in rehearsal is Sarah had wanted to go with Dance Kitten, I think. And again, because I kiboshed everyone on the cats. And she was just really struggling with which animal that she associated with. And I've always liked... We were thinking about logos at the time, and I wanted to use a banana because a banana is always linked in with comedy. Except Dan hated that idea. And then someone said, Sarah, you should be Dance Banana. And then she's so cute and sparkly and bubbly. And she'd also just gotten braces. You know, she's a 21-year-old who just got braces. And she just was Dance Banana. And like when Dan and I connected over the name Dance Animal, we're like, yeah, Sarah, you're Dance Banana. And that's just it. All of our, again, to... Because often the design team doesn't have a lot of interaction with the actors, and I really wanted our design team and anybody involved with the project, I wanted it to be very inclusive, because we were all going to have to work so hard. So all of my designers, all of my technicians, they all have animal names. So we have Dance Chicken, and what I especially like about our Dance Chicken is she's our stage manager, and there's that expression in French, mère poule, you know, who lords over the little ones, and she's great with the dancers. She's everything you could want, a director could want in a stage manager. She's firm, but she's friendly. She really gets the job done. So big ups to Bonnie Moore, great stage manager. And then we have our costume designer, who's Dance Panda. We have a photographer, who's Dance Koala. Yes, they're both bears, but I let them get away with that because they're different continents. And then we have Dance Toad, who's our videographer. And let's see, am I missing some? Dance Alligator, who's Pierre-Luc, our lighting and sound designer. And he wanted to go with Alligator because he's Francophone, so it could go both ways. And it's really funny that he would choose that one because he's so gentle, yet he's chosen a really aggressive animal. It's so curious to see who chooses what. And then... Once we started getting into the meat of the play, and I asked the actors to all write their own monologues, and which meant they had to think about their characters. And I gave them a lot of freedom. I said, you can choose the personality of your character, you can take inspiration from the actual animal traits, or you can make it up. It doesn't matter to me. Just be true, just create a character that you like. And if you like that character, then there's a good chance that we're going to like that character. And so I asked them to all come up with 2-minute monologues. And they presented them to myself and Dan. And again, we didn't have to do much work on them because they were so funny and really beautifully written. And so what Dan and I did is we took the monologues they'd written, and then we just built in some framework in terms of creating the storyline of the play and connecting the dots, exactly. And then we gave them back to the actors. The actors made their changes, we made our changes, and then we finally settled on these final monologues. So we are animals, but the animals are just more like our name. Like, you would be Zeke and I would be Robin. In the context of Dance Animal, I'm Dance Tiger, but I'm not a tiger, but I am. In future shows, when you see the animals on stage actually interacting, like speaking to each other, they'll probably refer to each other as Hawk, Banana, Tiger. But as far as the audience is concerned, it was really important for me right from the start that they always link us as to connect us to Dance Animals. So that's where the extension of Dance Tiger, Dance Fox, etc. comes from. Again, we are dance troops, so there is a uniform. I wanted to create a uniform. Again, just creating a look that is associated with Dance Animal, and I have 10 beautiful people in my group. They weren't cast by what they looked like. And when I say beautiful, I mean that because their personalities are just so special that in my eyes, they're gorgeous. And they, let's face it, they're all young and they've got beautiful bodies. And so I wanted to just highlight that. So I've put them, I designed their blacks. So we have a basic uniform of a dancer uniform, which is for the men, black tights, black tight tank top, a black sweat headband, black shoes. The women wear black tights, black leg warmers, black bodysuit, and again, a black sweatband. And then we just put costume pieces on top. But at no point do we wear our animal, like anything that links us to our animals. Well, they're introduced right off the top of the show, so all the audience know. But also, the strategy that I used with our postering campaign is that I took headshots of every animal, and what I did is I, instead of having one single poster, I have 10 different posters. So one poster for every character, and it says Joseph Bembridge is Dance Pony, Robin Henderson is Dance Tiger, Sarah Hansen is Dance Banana. And the idea being is that before the audience even walks into the room, they already know who each of us is. And creating branding, just branding the whole idea.
Tuesday, August 11th, at Gore. I go by AZ, by my side, Lady Royalty, and we be repping West Haven Village,
J2K,
Youth in Motion, Team Time.
Final audience discussion broadcast live on CKET 90.3.
It's a special edition of Lynx networking event, open to all ages, Team Time.
We'll discuss teen issues like
drugs,
relationships,
politics and media,
Obama to Michael Jackson,
police, justice system,
organized by Cool Active, a part of the YMCA Youth Exchange Program involving teens from Montreal and Toronto.
Team time. Don't forget that date again, Tuesday, August 11th, live on Soul Perspective on CKUT 90.3 FM, 7 to 9 p.m. from Gore Resto Lounge. It's going down Paul 40 Crescent Corner from St. Catchin. Team time.
And we're back. It's 2:56, and I realize I've been, what is the word? Bad.
Negligent.
Negligent. Yeah, that's the fancy one. I prefer bad. It's 2:56, 2:57 almost. It's CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to Movement Museum talking about dance on the radio. And if you're listening to it via your computer, or if you want to, you can also listen to it via your computer. You can email us at movement@ckut.ca, I think is, yes, movement is ckut.ca. And we have 3 minutes to deal with the awesome Montreal dance calendar. It's a good thing there's not an awful lot of dance happening. It's sunny, it's warm, it's hot and humid. Nobody really wants to dance. So yes, there today we're the only thing happening in dance in Montreal. But tomorrow there are a couple of things. There's Latin Fridays, Papo Ros and Orchestra Pembiche. I have no idea how to pronounce that. They're doing something at Tohu, which is 2345 Jarry East, and this Dominican big band presents the very best of merengue, salsa, bachata, and cumbia. Or, if you prefer, at 8 o'clock, there's Furies Alpha 1-24, The Monsters Within, by Montreal Dance. That's happening at Théâtre de la Verdure, which is, Montréal Danse, propulsé par la rage, la tendresse et une monstrueuse séduction. Cette chorégraphe propose une réponse sensible et nécessaire à l'horreur des drames humains et exprime les émotions provoquées par ces tragédies. It's choreography by Estelle Clareton, and you can find out more information at montrealdancewithans.com. And then, yeah, all of this stuff in terms of the complete awesome Montreal dance calendar is available on our blog website, which is movement-museum.com. www.blogspot.com. But I think Rachel's got a couple of gigs that we might want to tell you about.
And also, if listeners out there know of any dance things that are happening that are maybe a little bit more underground and we haven't mentioned them, please let us know on the blog and we will surely make them known. La Compagnie Marie Chouinard is still looking for a directeur, directrice de production, responsibilities for planifier, superviser et coordonner le travail de l'équipe de production, prévoir, négocier et contrôler les frais de production, planifier et trouver les ressources techniques nécessaires à la réalisation de la production et assister la direction artistique. That's going to be running. It's a temporary job, full-time, until the 12th of March 2010. And if you're interested, you should get in touch with Marie Chouinard, and their web address is www.mariechouinard.com. They are also holding open auditions for female dancers and hiring date to be determined, and male dancers with immediate hiring with very strong technique and arresting stage presence. So just pop along to their website for more details on that. Studio KMK Dance, situé sur la rue Masson à Montréal, est à la recherche d'un professeur de tap dance ainsi que jig irlandaise pour la saison 2009-2010.
Yeah, I think you have the right accent for it. I think you should apply.
I don't know. I think that would be quite farcical. But if any of you can teach tap dancing and Irish jig, either or both, please send your candidature to info@studiokmkdance.com. And then finally, we have an audition for Virtual Dance Pro. It's Saturday, the 12th of September, au Studio Biz, 551 Avenue Montréal Est. And they're looking for male and female dancers, male and female singers, circus artists and musicians, and their number, Virtual Dance Pro, 514-677-4390, or email donald.corbeil, C-O-R-B-E-I-L, at hotmail.com.
Thank you very much. And thank you all out there for listening to us. We've gone over time and positive vibes is coming up. So we're out of here. This has been Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Damn.